So do I have the right time now?
Yeah, this is just fine.
Yeah, okay, cool. I thought we could just do it sort of semi-ramblingly. I'll just give you some feeling lines or something, and you just say what's on your mind about different episodes and stuff.
That'll be just fine.
Yeah. So, okay, to begin with, before you joined the Magic Band, you were a fan of the group.
Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
Pretty much the band, the Trout Mask Band, John French, Jeff Cotton, Mark Boston, and I were all in groups in the same basic town as the Beefheart Band was.
Okay.
And we were all fans. They were the older guys. We were 8, 10 years younger than they were. And yeah, we were big fans.
Yeah. So, and you joined them in 67?
68.
68, yeah.
68.
And now, and the Magic Band actually, for I don't know how many months, was it 6 or more months that you actually shared the house and lived together during the rehearsals?
Of Trout Mask? It was close, it was more like a year.
Oh, a year, okay.
Yeah, it was a year, and I think it was, 9 months or so that, from the time that I got there, that let me see, is that right? February? Yeah. I would say 8, 9 months that we were rehearsing the album.
Yeah. And as I understand from your book, that was sometimes a traumatic experience?
Most of the time.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Now, there's one anecdote there about somebody... You didn't always have much money for food and things.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one episode you mentioned where Beefheart and Zappa sort of cajoles you into doing a raid on a...
Oh, no. A little bit different than what you're saying.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Yes, we were starving.
Yeah.
And my mother and Don's mother, Captain Beefheart,
yeah,
pretty much gave us money to pay rent and stuff at the time. We went and raided a supermarket, not a super, but a grocery place.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, I didn't, because I kind of figured out that they knew what was going on, because we were pretty strange-looking characters and a very otherwise, what they would consider normal. And so with a bunch of food in our pants and stuff, the three of us got arrested, and then Zappa bailed us out.
Okay.
He was the one that had the money.
Mm.
And he actually was very nice about that, because he never said a word to us about that.
Yeah. But then Beefheart goes around and says, how could you do a thing like that? Or
yeah, exactly. After, it was his idea to send us there. But,
yeah,
you know, why would you do that? You know, well, gee.
Yeah.
But we were stupid enough to do it. So
you'd say that Don Van Fleet was a... Or could be a manipulative person?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. I believe we all are, but it's just how self-fulfilling those things are, and how unconscionable, or how it's not nice to the person that you're manipulating, and that's more what he was doing. He was very much serving his own needs.
Mm. You could talk a little bit about some of the very popular myths about the album, especially the famous or infamous story about Van Vliet supposedly composing the whole stuff in 8 hours and then teaching it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you and Drumbo especially have different perspectives on...
Well, yeah, we were there.
Yeah, right.
He didn't compose it in that amount of time, it was an evolution of a long time. Don never, in my time in the band, in the 7 years, never actually composed anything. He sculpted and pushed things around, but to my knowledge, the only time he might have had a specific intent would be to play something very standard blues-based.
All right.
But during the Trout Mask things, we got the piano, and he would pound around on the piano, And granted, he didn't spend a lot of time on it, but he would go over and beat around on it. And again, I'm not trying to de-emphasize what he was doing, because I think he had a great concept of the big picture, but Don didn't know music at all.
Right.
And so he would pound things out on the piano, and then John French, Drumbo, would notate it, and then the rest of us would get together and work out the parts and figure out how to play them.
Hmm.
And then after the fact, he would push things around, change things a bit, sculpt them, and so forth.
But, yeah.
The idea that we didn't play and he taught us how to play things is way out of whack.
Yeah, yeah.
We all played, you know, that we didn't play before we got there. We played for years before we got there.
Hmm.
And but he did very much influence how we approached things, for sure.
Yeah. Like, for instance, he taught you to strum the guitar a special way, or more ferociously than usual, or...
Exactly. More aggressively was a big part of it.
Yeah.
Strumming things that were even single note,
like
riffs, which is standard practice now, but at that time it took a great transformation of learning how to mute strings and strum one note at a time, but while you're hitting all six strings, and it creates a lot more powerful sound. Anyway, there's a lot of standard issue blues guys that play that way. Jimi Hendrix and Stevie Ray Vaughan come to mind, but we were doing it with a lot stranger things that were going on in our fingers tips.
So you have both at the same time, you have a strange way of playing, and then the music itself is strange. So
it made it real strong. That was some of the funny parts about it, is that Don seemed to like these real corny little melodies that would be really simple and nursery rhyme like, childlike.
Yep.
But then the way we would attack them and play them, and what else was surrounding them with the other instruments, would really put them in a funny place. So it made it very cartoonish.
Yep.
Very animated.
Hmm.
So he was really good at those type concepts. It's just that the idea that he had a specific tension, like he's going to write a piece of music, he didn't work that way at all.
If you take the songs on Trout Mask, there are a few songs there where there's a sort of connection between the instruments and what he's singing, but in other places it's like his lines, his vocals, is one completely different song imposed upon what you are playing.
Well, that's why it was recorded that way. When when he did the vocal overdubs, which nobody was there, just Frank, the engineer Dick Kunk, and Don, he didn't listen to the tracks when he sang the vocals.
Okay.
Yeah. He listened to the... He had headphones on, but all he had in his headphones was his own vocal.
Okay.
And he wanted only the bleed-through coming through the studio room, through the glass, out into the actual recording room. And Frank Zappa tried to talk him out of doing that, but that's what Don wanted.
Okay.
Could have been any number of reasons. He never rehearsed with us.
Yeah.
It created a different effect, too. So I'll give it its positive due that he conceptually was trying to create something that was very different and free form on the top. And the other part was that he never practiced with us and never was able to really repeat the things that he had done.
Yeah, because this is also a thing that you and French and others have said, that he had a difficult time remembering his own lyrics. Because I've heard a few live concerts on tape where he seems lost a lot of the time. So
you got it.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And if there was a problem, it was our fault.
Right.
The funny thing about that is, and so it makes me almost like want to think about what was going on with the man during this period. The songs he would remember were ones that he learned earlier on.
All right.
We'd go in and do Abba's Abba from the first album, Safe as Milk, and he'd know the lyrics.
Mm.
Any of the tunes that he had constructed from Trout Mask on, he wouldn't ever know the lyrics.
All right.
So I'm not sure if it was a particular change or how the tunes were constructed, or the fact that the earlier tunes were very written out simplistic lyrically and were put together then he was more of a part of how they were put together.
Hmm.
The Trout Mask, he was in the bedroom sleeping while we were working on the farm.
Right.
And again, I'm not saying, you know, like this guy was an utter asshole. He was very capable of being one, but it was a way to be very distant and apart from it to create something pretty creative.
Yeah. So you could say that his strange way of being sometimes was a necessary evil to get the results that came out?
Not totally, but yes, in some ways, for sure.
Hmm.
The only problem I guess I have with that is that consistently doing that way, it's a mess.
Yeah, yeah.
To do that sometimes, to experiment with different ways to put things together is really good.
Hmm.
If I learned anything in that band, it was that there's a lot of different ways to put music together and a lot of different attitudes you can have about it.
Yeah. If you could talk a little bit about some of the individual songs to get more into that. For instance, the first, the opening track, Frownland, that's one of the more experimental rhythmically. The music track itself is very experimental. And then on top of that, Don is, Van Vliet is, like I said, singing a completely different melody.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, the melodies were almost, I won't call it, I don't know if you're familiar with Ornette Coleman harmelodic.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
I'm not either, well, I shouldn't say either, you might be. But the way tunes like that one have, he has his own melody. He'll fall into his own melody,
yeah,
and it creates its own melody. And if I'm in a different key, a lot of times we were in three different keys, three different time signatures.
Mm.
But there might be a rhythmic pulse that would hold us together.
Right.
And through the amount of repetitions, there would be a point where they touched down again.
Yeah.
And then at that point is when we'd move on to another section. And those were calculated. And that rings true through almost most of the album, at least the basic 20 tracks or so that were the studio recorded tracks, not the Elegaroo, not Elegaroo, I mean China Pig or any of those kind of things. Right?
Yeah, right.
But Frownland or Neon Me Dream of an Octafish or any of these tunes that were densely constructed, they just go along and then touch down musically and to a point, whatever the repetitions were, and then we would go on from there.
Yeah.
Most of the tunes of that have no repeats in them.
Okay, yeah. So,
as far as the way his, I would have to go back and listen to it, you know.
Yeah.
It's something that's quite a long time ago for me. And don't,
oh, yeah.
But I do remember the guitar riff, and that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I think, you mentioned Elegaroo, that that could be one of the more almost normal tunes on the album.
Yeah, it is.
That sort of repeated choruses.
And yeah, the repeated part in it, right.
Yeah.
Let me see. Yeah, Elegaroo, the two tunes that were Veterans Day Poppy and Sugar and Spikes, and Moonlight on Vermont.
Yeah.
Those things were written and done previous to the onslaught of the Trout Mask material, so those tunes stand out as being, you know, more standard issue stuff, too.
Hmm. Yeah, and those tunes also had a different bass player, is that right?
Gary Marker played bass on Moonlight in Vermont and Veterans Day Poppy, yeah.
Okay.
I had just joined the band and we had just worked on, Moonlight in Vermont was written actually right after Strictly Personal, before Trout Mask.
Okay.
Moonlight in Vermont, Sugar and Spikes. Veterans Day Poppy is the first tune that was worked out when I joined the band.
Mm.
And that was before Mark, my friend Mark Boston, Rockette, joined the band. And so we went in the studio really quick. So that was my first recording session. I must say I was quite nervous with Frank in the control room there.
Okay, yeah.
He was another of my heroes at that time.
I think when you mentioned it, I think you say something in the book about Veterans Day Poppy, that the final part was inspired by something Zappa showed you on guitar. Could that be?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was just kind of fiddling around in the living room, and I was playing something close to some chord, and he said, "Hey, well, play this thing," you know.
Okay, yeah.
And I didn't know at the time it was a minor nine chord, but a pretty simple thing, but it just, oh man, this sounds cool, you know, how you find a little nugget that's, when you don't know what you're doing and you find something that's pretty, a chord form that's pretty elevated, it gets pretty dense, it's pretty cool. And so he's showing me these chords and checking them out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then as I was playing it around with it, Don liked the sound of it, obviously, too, and then we started working it into the second half of the tune, the slow part.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the track Hair Pie that has, there are two different versions of it.
Which is the same track by us.
Okay, yeah.
Right? But it's just that one was recorded at the house when we were going to do the whole album at the house with the kids out in the brush and stuff.
Yeah.
Right, that actually just walk up on them.
Oh, yeah, when they say, when he talks to the two, yeah, right.
Where do you live? That's nice and all of that.
Mm. And then you hear the...
Can you imagine being a 12, 14-year-old kid walking down the street seeing this guy out there in the weeds with his horn?
Yeah.
But the other, Hair Pie Bake 2, is the same track, it's just it was done in the studio.
Mm.
And I guess with the Grow Fins box set. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, right.
You're right.
So you have these rehearsals for the...
Right, that has those rehearsal tapes. And,
yeah.
And, boy, that was strange for me to listen to that stuff. I'm hearing things I'm saying as a 19-year-old kid.
Right.
I'm 50 now, so...
Yeah.
You know, we're talking 31 years ago, and I'm hearing things that I said then that I didn't know they were recorded, and... Yeah, it's pretty strange.
That must be strange, yeah.
Yeah, it is. But it let me know, you know, again, listening to them and listening to the tracks, we knew the tunes pretty well.
Hmm. And then, of course, on the one version, you have the so-called Mascara Snake, who was Dan Van Fleet's cousin.
Right.
How would you put, as nicely as you could, your feelings about him and Van Fleet's horn playing?
Okay.
As
nicely as I can. You read the book.
You know. Yeah, right.
Victor was a nice guy.
Hmm.
I liked Victor. He was trying very hard to be very hip, and he was a painter, you know? That's what he was.
Hmm.
So he was around a lot and fit everything but the physical ability to play the instrument. He fit in with the lot of us.
Okay?
Hmm. So... the idea of being more artistic and worrying more about the artistic content than the musical content, he fit in with that.
Yeah.
I was a musician, so it was hard for me to deal with somebody walking in and pushing air through a horn and getting credit. I slaved so hard on these tunes.
Hmm.
You know, let me just play over the top, too.
Yeah, right.
You know. But it wouldn't have worked, and there's again, there, in hindsight, there's no problem with that, and maybe it worked really great. But when you're inside there and you're doing all the dirty work, you know, to put it together, you know, it's a little tough to watch somebody just kind of float around with a horn in their mouth.
Yeah,
was that nice enough?
And I think you can use that. Yeah. but there you touch upon certain other aspects about the internal pressures and arguments within the group. For instance, the source about the band members quitting and returning very often. And when the album first came out, for instance, then the Mascara Snake was credited, but Drumbo was not.
That's right.
So
Don was very mad at John.
Yeah.
And you don't get credit after... his monumental effort,
right?
Don's monumental effort to transcribe what Don had done and work the parts out with us, and John had really worked very hard, and that was Don's mood ruled the situation. So.
Hmm. But then, of course, Drembo returned
four or five times, I think.
Yeah.
John's a very good friend of mine, but that I guess that would be the one thing I'd never understand. But
that he would return?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, boy, you must like abuse. I'm sure as it got later, the relationship they had, and it must have been a lot easier.
Mm.
But John was very serious about it. He really cared about the music.
So. Yeah. One of my personal favorite tracks is a tune called Pachuco Cadaver.
Mm-hmm.
There we have... I think the, you, when you talk about the lyrics and the music, Troutmask Replica has always been described as very strange and very sort of non-user friendly or whatever, but at the same time there's a lot of positivism in the lyrics, and you know, I think Pachuco Cadaver is sort of a very nice upbeat tune.
Definitely.
Especially that riff at the end, which you say was later used again in the tune Spotlight Kid, is that right?
What was the tune that was used in?
The Pachuco Cadaver. The end. Yeah. The ending riff was used in Spotlight Kid.
I would have to. I'm sorry. I'd have to listen to him.
Okay. Yeah.
Remember him. But I will say this: Don always used riffs from other songs, turned them around.
Mm.
He had his own reservoir of favorite things, favorite sounds that kind of just grew through his time with various members through the band, and he would always redo them.
Mm.
If I remember, he redid a tune later called Suction Prince that was actually Pachuco Cadaver.
Okay, yeah.
Henry Kaiser listed all that stuff in the book. He helped me out with all that because he knew all the stuff that happened after I left the band. But in a large way, the tunes that came out during Troutmask was so much stuff that was such a blast of creativity, especially lyrically from Don,
because
the lyrics were where his thing really happened.
Yep.
Again, we were more workmanlike in the music stuff. But he would, I think a lot of tunes that came out in later albums came really from stuff that was started and ignited, let's say, in the Troutmask period.
Yeah, I think that's a fact, or that's generally agreed upon, that the two or three last albums were very much earlier tunes. From the 71, 72 period. Or
right, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's how he liked to work. He would, he would literally say, well, what's that riff in Pachuco Cadaver? You play that now.
Mm.
You know, we'd play that, then we'd, you know, kind of build off of that and go somewhere.
Mm.
He definitely had his favorites.
Yeah.
And that was one, boy, we played that a lot.
Yeah. And then you also have a sort of more swingier fast, funny tunes like My Human Gets Me Blues and When Big Jones Sets Up.
Right.
So those kind of tunes, perhaps you were more likely to perform those live than the other stranger tracks.
Yeah, ones that were easier to reproduce.
Yeah.
And things that I think the tunes that got picked to be played live were definitely ones that Don was more comfortable with.
Hmm.
Big Joan really fits in with that. Hair Pie we did a bit, too. One of my personal favorites was Steal Softly Through Snow.
Okay, yeah.
Just musically and lyrically, just there was some... It's a great combo of some really serious kind of landscape painting type stuff and humor. And to stick those things together, it's kind of really funny to do that, but... really, really like that. Musically, it's really elevated, and it's. I kind of, anytime I can hang on to things that had maybe a Coltrane feel to it or something.
Yeah.
That had that really strong, because thinking of the 60s, I was really influenced by the strong African American jazz scene.
Hmm.
And there was a lot of those elements in our tunes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because we listened to a lot of it. So Steal Softly Through Snow had a lot of that in it.
Yeah, I think Steal Softly Through Snow, we're going to play that in a sort of a step-like, we have the finished version, and then we have the On the Grow Fins set, the instrumental rehearsal version.
Yeah.
And then there's on the John French drum solo album, there's his Steal Softly Through Snow drums.
He plays the drums,
right? Yeah, so we could sort of dissect that song.
Very good.
Yeah. I don't know. You said you haven't had any contact with Dan Fanfleet for several years. There are these strange, or not so strange, rumors going about his health, and it's been speculated that he had MS, multiple sclerosis. Or did you ever hear this CD he came out with 10 years ago or something that was a part of his book of paintings?
I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Actually, a person, Morgan Argren, you know of him?
I think I know the name, yeah.
Yeah.
He's a
Swedish drummer.
Okay, no.
Mattson Morgan. Anyway, he had, when Don had done some paintings, was involved in this book and the CD and so forth, and he had done a bunch of cover recordings of tunes, but he had told me about it. I haven't heard the particular CD that you're talking about, but are we talking about how he sounds, where he doesn't sound very good on it?
Yeah, because he reads 5 short poems, and his voice is sort of stilted and sort of broken.
Right.
So to me, he sounded very ill at
It's confirmed. I mean, Art Tripp was a chiropractor, and I think Art last saw him about 6 years ago.
Okay.
And Art was the first person to tell him that you have some physical problems here and you need to go get it checked out, and it was pretty much confirmed.
Okay.
I won't say 100%, I'll say 99% that he has MS. And I've heard that there's the possibility of strokes past that.
Okay.
Through a guitar player, Joe Gore, who works with P.J. Harvey, who was, I guess, a big fan, and she would be calling him all the time.
Okay.
Through that connection, I pretty much think that's what's going on.
Okay. Yeah, and by the way, do you have any contact with the other ex-Magic Band members today?
Yes, I do.
Yep.
John French all the time.
Hmm.
As a matter of fact, John was not playing drums, had kind of quit and was working on computer work, and then he just started playing again.
Okay.
And so he will be playing with me on my CD when I finally get it done.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So
that's good news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that happening soon, or is it a sort of long-term project?
Well, it was happening soon a while ago, and then I have some commitments through my basic jobs that I will be done with January 1. They're computer-based things that Y2K have to be fixed. So
yeah, okay, you're right.
As of January 1, then I will just not be doing that job, and then I'll get busy and finish this up.
Mm.
I got probably half of one done right at this point. It's too bad I've waited too long. It would have been nice if I would have had it done 6 months ago, but I just had some commitments.
Yeah.
So as of January 1, I've lined up some musicians and some things that I'm doing.
Hmm. So, how about Mark Boston? Is he...
We just finally got a hold of him.
Yeah.
He was in North Carolina, somewhere on the East Coast of the United States.
Hmm.
And I hadn't heard from him in a few years, and when the box set, the Girl Fenn's box set out, they gave us small checks.
Okay.
Which was nice of him.
Yep.
And we were looking for him and didn't find him, and my younger brother ran into him at a barbecue.
Hmm. Just accidentally?
Huh?
Just accidentally?
Yeah. And so I finally got a hold of him, and we straightened it out, and I'm sure he's got his check by now. So.
Yep.
But I've talked to him just a couple of times recently. Those are the only two. Art Tripp I keep in touch with.
Yep.
Jeff Cotton, I don't. He lives in Hawaii, I think.
Mm.
Hasn't been any contact there. Later members, nah, not really.
Nah. Okay. Let's see, is there anything else here? Well, I think we have all we need now, so just one final question.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're going to do most of this program, it'll be a 2-hour program, we're going to do most of it pretty straightforward, but we're going to have a fake interview with Ella Gru. So we have a sort of girl with a convincing American accent to. So, do you have any?
Ella, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. Would you have any special kind of greeting to Ella or?
Greetings to Ella. Ella Guru, how are you doing after all of those years?
Okay. So we'll see what she has to answer to that.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to just thank you for your time, and I don't know, would you be interested in a tape of the program, or you wouldn't be able to understand much of it? But
I wouldn't understand much of it. That's fine. Yeah. That way I'd just be putting you through the rigors there.
Yeah.
I just appreciate your interest.
Yeah. So, okay, nice talking to you, and best of luck. And
okay, thanks, Tom.
I'll be looking for your record.
Please do.
Yep. Okay, thank you again. Bye-bye.
Bye.